This interview is for the Library of Congress Veterans History Project with Kermit L. Hardin, Jr. of Urbana, who was in the U.S. Army from March 20, 1943 to December 15, 1945. Mr. Hardin served in Europe with Company K of the 301st Infantry, 94th Division, as a private first class. My name is Harriet Williamson. Henry Radcliffe is the Director of Sound, Lighting, and Videography. Also in the studio is Harriet Ann Steinrauf Hardin and Andrew Hardin. We are in the television studio of WILL in Urbana, Illinois, on the University of Illinois campus. Today is Friday, October 27, 2007, which is also Mr. Hardin's birthday. Speaking of your birthday, would you like to talk about your family, your background, and your education, Mr. Hardin?
I have a family of course, my mother and father, and I had two brothers and two sisters. One brother died when he was only 5 years old, and we lived on a farm. And I grew up on a farm. And
where were you born?
Born in McQuan, Illinois.
Okay, where is
Knox
that?
Knox County.
Uh-huh.
In I was the first. I was the oldest of my father was rather unique. He had five children before he was 16 years, or before he was 21 years old.
Oh my goodness.
We were a farm family. My father then later became an engineer for a mining company. But we still farmed. He did both jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So I graduated in high school and came to the University of Illinois. Spent three semesters here until I enlisted. I was here when Pearl Harbor happened.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, everyone dashed out and enlisted the next week or so. And I was just old enough to enlist, and enlisted in December and was called into service in March of 1943.
How did you choose to be in the Army?
Oh, I don't know. I guess it just seemed like everybody else was going to the Army. It was.
Mm-hmm. Did you enlist with some friends?
Oh, yeah, lots of friends here on the campus.
And did they stay with you during your experience in the military?
Not a single one with me, but in my experience I ran into an awful lot of college-age men.
Now, what were you studying when you came to the University of Illinois before you enlisted in the Army?
I was going to be a math or history teacher.
Uh-huh.
And
had you been following the news of the world at that point in time, and do you think you had an understanding of what was happening?
Oh, I don't remember that too much. I remember that everyone was sort of surprised with the attack at Pearl Harbor, and that sort of brought everything into focus at that particular time. Of course, the draft was in force, but I wasn't old enough to be drafted, so I didn't worry too much about that.
Mm-hmm. So how old were you then when you did enlist?
I came to the university when I was 16 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So
you were 17 then when you enlisted?
Actually, I'm born in October, so I'm 16 for the first 2 months of my first year here.
Mm-hmm.
Then I'm 17, and then I was just 2 months older at 18 when I enlisted.
So you were extremely young when you joined the military.
Well, I was young in age, but I wasn't unique because there were a lot of people same age I was and so forth.
Now, where did you start your boot camp training?
I went to Camp Robinson in Arkansas for basic training, and I was there only 3 weeks when I was pulled out of there and sent to Carnegie Institute, well, it was Carnegie Technology in Pittsburgh, to study to be an engineer. So I attended college, really, there in an engineering curriculum for 3 semesters.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did that come about? How did they take you and say, you know, you should go into engineering training?
Well, when you went into the service, you took, sort of a placement type test. Mm-hmm. And a result of that, I guess they thought that I could be a good engineer and, mm-hmm. and ask if I wanted to do it, go to school, and I, of course, did.
Now, what kinds of things did you learn at Carnegie?
It was a regular college curriculum in engineering, just mm-hmm. the regular math, engineering courses, mm-hmm. and just like a regular student there.
Now, when you were there, did you know that you were going to eventually be taken back and sent back into maybe a theater of war?
Well, what the prognosis of this was that we'd become an officer in the Army mm-hmm. and go into active duty. Mm-hmm. But this was to be after you had completed your engineering training. Mm-hmm. What happened was that they curtailed the program before we finished up.
Did they curtail the program because they needed infantry?
Well, they didn't really need a lot of engineers, I think, was uh-huh. the main thing. And of course, they were getting ready for the invasion of Europe, uh-huh. and they were building up the armed forces and so uh-huh. forth. So when I left there, I went back to the infantry. Uh-huh. And it was very unique for a lot of my friends because I never took basic training, only those 3 weeks.
Oh, my goodness.
But that, again, was there were a lot of us in that situation mm-hmm. that were there. So
when you left Carnegie, then where did you go next?
I went to Camp McCain, Mississippi.
Mm-hmm. And what happened there? What was
an advanced infantry training division, mm-hmm. And you were getting ready to go to Europe or go to war somewhere.
Did you know that you were going to Europe?
No, okay. Didn't know you were going to Europe until mm-hmm. they actually assigned the division.
Now, what kind of training for advanced infantry? What was involved in that?
Oh, and marksmanship and patrol work, and just mock battles. Mm-hmm. It was very realistic type of mm-hmm. training.
Okay, so you are there, and then what is your next? What happened next?
Next,
how long were you there, by the way?
Well, I went there in March of 43, mm-hmm. and was there till again, I don't remember August of 43. Mm-hmm. When we were assigned to go to Europe.
Okay, so then you were sent by train to
I can't even remember the camp in New York, staging area. Mm-hmm. We were there 2 days while we were getting ready to get on the boat. And again, I had a very rather unique experience, one of the few that got to go across the ocean on the Queen Elizabeth, which was the largest mm-hmm. ship afloat at that time. And of course, we went underscored because we could outrun everything that was in the ocean, but didn't seem to worry any. It was 18,000 of us on the ship.
That's remarkable. What was it like being on that ship? What was a daily life like, and how long did the crossing take?
It took about 5.5 days, mm-hmm. and you ate in shifts. The kitchen operated 24 hours. Mm-hmm. You slept whenever you could. Half the time you had a bunk in the hold of the ship, and the other half you just had to be out on deck and sleeping because mm-hmm. of the space and everything. Mm-hmm. But it was nice weather, warm. It was no problem.
What was the mood on the ship?
Oh, I think it was happy. Mm-hmm. A lot of poker games.
So the destination then was England?
Yeah, it was Scotland, really. We went to Edinburgh mm-hmm. And docked. The ship docked there in the Firth of Clyde. Mm-hmm. The water wasn't deep enough for it to get to the shore, so we had to go in with climb down rope ladders off the boat and get into little dinghies and ride ashore.
Okay, so you're in Edinburgh now, and then where did
Got a train from? And went to town called Chippenham, which is down in, I guess you'd call it south central England. And we were there for 4 weeks. Mm. Again, some training, mainly just a staging area, and, mm-hmm. until we could go. Now, this was August, and D-Day had been the previous June. Mm-hmm. So we knew we were going to go to France, mm-hmm. but just didn't know when. So,
were you able to communicate with people back home all during your training and going into England?
Oh, yeah. Well, mm-hmm. you wrote letters and stuff, but mm-hmm. which, you know, took 2 or 3 weeks sometimes to get back and forth. There mm-hmm. wasn't any airmail or anything like that. So,
had you developed friendships at this point in time with people that you were with?
Well, you become very close to the people in your company because mm-hmm. you learn to depend on each other and so forth. So,
when did orders come down then to go to your...
I don't remember the exact date. It was first or second week of September. Mm-hmm. We went across the channel. And that was no problem either. We went across the channel. The only problem was we had to wade ashore because there weren't any docks there. We landed in what was Omaha Beach. Mm-hmm. But by that time, the beach had been cleared, and we were there wasn't anybody shooting at us when we got out there. Mm-hmm. You know? So,
when then did you get into actual combat? So you're in France. And
we moved from the beach area down to the town outside the town of Lorient. Mm-hmm. And part of our division was there. I was around Lorient. The other part of it went to Saint-Nazaire. Those are two ports there on the western edge of France.
What was the strategy for your particular...
Well, you knew about the war. That was, they had, our armed forces had broken out of the deadlock, if you want to call it, at the beach. I think the original theory was that we'd get off that beach in about 2 weeks or so, but it took 3 or 4. Mm-hmm. And little town of Saint-Lô, the tanks broke out of there one day and just ran as fast as they could across France, and they cut off $65,000 Germans in the town of Lorient and Saint-Nazaire. Mm-hmm. And they were completely cut off from getting to back home. And our first assignment was to keep them there. Mm-hmm. And they stayed there until 3 days after the end of the war. So they were there for a long time.
So did they then become prisoners of war, or was that just continuing?
No, they were very active. We would run patrols in there occasionally to see if they were trying to do anything. There was always the thought that they might try and break out of there. Mm-hmm. Well, 65,000 men, that's quite a... Mm-hmm. And they were having trouble supplying them because there was blockade, and that was Atlantic Ocean on the other side, and they blockaded that. So they were mainly supplied by submarines. Mm-hmm. And Lorient, there was tremendous submarine pins there, which are still there today, in fact.
So that's part of the strategy, was to destroy those submarine bases?
Oh, they couldn't. Mm-hmm. Bomb could make a direct hit. They had 18-foot concrete top on them, so a bomb didn't mm-hmm. do anything to them. Oh, you can go there today, and they look like they were, other than just the oldness of it, you thought they were built 10 years ago.
Now, have you been back?
Yes.
How many times have you been back to Europe?
I've been to Europe 4 times.
Mm-hmm. And have you visited the various sites where you fought?
Oh, yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. About 3 years ago, we had we were invited back by the town where we were captured. And I was captured in the Lorient section. That's mm-hmm. where I became prisoner. And so we went back, and they've got a museum there. With a lot of the material that I brought with me here mm-hmm. that's on display there. And, in fact, we've been invited to go back again this June for a celebration of some mm-hmm. sort.
So do you attend the reunions then?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Not every one of them, but I've been to a lot of them. They're getting smaller and smaller, you know.
So you were in combat for how many days then before you were captured?
Combat may not be the right word. because we're in this holding. I mean, it was really boring. The only activity was when you went out on patrol. And then sometimes you'd go out on patrol and wouldn't find anything, and sometimes you'd get shot at. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you'd get surrounded and get chaptered, like I did.
Is that what happened? You were on patrol?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And why don't you talk about that, what that experience was like?
Well, it was a pretty bad day. There were 55 of us on patrol. It was a big patrol. We got surrounded, and five were killed and 23 wounded from about 9 o'clock in the morning till dark. Mm-hmm. And our forces tried to come in and relieve the surrounding, but they couldn't get through either. Mm-hmm. So it was getting dark, and mortars were coming in on us all the time, and so we decided we couldn't really, and we were running out of ammunition too. So,
So then you were captured by the Germans.
Yes.
And then what happened after that?
Well, we went into the town of Lorient and stayed at what they called a prison. It was really some sort of manufacturing building, and they built a fence around it to enclose it. Mm-hmm. And we were there for probably a week, and during that time we were being interrogated by their intelligence people. Then after that was over, they put us on a boat and took us out to the Ile de Groix, which is out in the bay, about 3 miles out in the Atlantic Ocean. Little island, maybe 5 miles long and a couple miles wide, and there was a big fort there, and that was our prison camp.
Were there other people who had also been imprisoned there besides the people?
Well, not from your there had been some. It was relatively new because they'd only been surrounded there for 3 weeks, so they didn't. They had British, and and a few, they had some Frenchmen and us. There were 146 or 49 Americans captured. Some of those were severely wounded and were taken to a hospital in Lorient and spent the whole time in the hospital. Mm-hmm. I was not hurt at all. The big problem was that we didn't get anything to eat. Mm. In that 45 days, I lost 40 pounds.
So you hadn't?
Well, you got some, what they called coffee in the morning, which was barley water heated up, I think, or something, and some black bread. And once in a while, the French, who were still living there, of course, would smuggle in apples or things like that for us. But we didn't have very much. And then, of course, we stole like mad. We were in this fort. It had a moat and everything else. And we were confined. And so we had finally asked if we could go for walks or just get out of there or something. And so they started letting us do that. There'd be a couple of guards at the head of the column and a couple of guards at the back. They weren't too worried about us going anywhere because we'd had to swim 3 miles or so. And so we would walk through this little island and come to some poor farmer's garden. It wouldn't take long to clean out a row of radishes or sugar beets or anything else growing there.
Was there a currency in the camp, like cigarettes or?
No cigarettes or anything. So
escape was impossible, and
well, one of the things they tell you if you're ever captured, you're supposed to always consider how to escape. Mm-hmm. Well, it didn't take us long to consider that wasn't too good an idea there,
Were you did you segregate yourselves into nationalities, or was everybody?
Well, we were segregated. Mm-hmm. We we were all Americans where I was in this particular type.
Did any leaders come to the fore and do things like try and organize activities or?
Oh, we played a lot of bridge. We made cards out of cardboard and played bridge. We learned to steal, I guess, would be the big thing we could. They once in a while they'd need people to haul food from the dock up to the fort, and they'd have us do that. And I remember one time three of us stole a whole bag, I mean about a 50-pound bag of carrots by just sticking them down in our pants and everywhere else.
While you were there, did you receive any communication from the outside world in terms of either letters from home or news of what was going on in terms of the war?
No. Well, of course, we were declared missing in action to our family, so they didn't know whether we were alive or not. My mother did write three letters, I didn't receive them until Christmas, when we were exchanged. She sent them through the Red Cross. Mm-hmm. And the Red Cross the Red Cross was very helpful because they was a source of communication.
So they would visit the camps?
Well, no, they wouldn't visit. But they were, there was a Red the documentary that All for One English Officer that W.I.L. has shown before sort of identifies the English officer was he was trying to escape. In fact, he did escape. He was not on the island. He was on the mainland, and he did escape a couple of times and got captured and brought back. And
so he swam.
No, he did not swim. He was still on the mainland. He wasn't assigned. The British were not out on the island where we were.
Okay.
So,
now was there communication with the guards? Then did they talk?
Oh,
with
yes,
you?
Yes.
And were
yeah,
they,
yeah.
So they were humane. It was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In fact, I learned to play chess from a German guard. Mm-hmm. He had a chess set, and the guards were pretty bored too. They were usually older, men that were probably too old for combat, I don't think it was a big job to keep us there.
So then how did you get released? Because you had mentioned that you were there for 45 days. So.
Well, there was a Red Cross man by the name of Jiro Hodges with our division. And the main communication was with French. The French could run between both lines. Mm-hmm. They apparently got word that we were in there and we were starving. And so he one day just got in his Jeep with a white flag and drove right into the German lines and said he was a Red Cross person and he wanted to visit us. And they said no. And then he said, well, he wanted to send in some food and clothes. It was getting winter, and we had, of course, the day we were captured, it was probably 80 degrees, and we didn't have really warm clothes, and there was no heat where we lived. And we eventually got a little potbelly stove that we could heat up and warm us up a little. And he came in and he arranged. We did finally get some cigarettes and old Henry bars through him that the Germans. He brought to the Germans and he got a receipt from them that they were going to deliver them and everything else. And of course, he never knew until later whether they were ever delivered or not, but they were. Mm-hmm. And I didn't smoke, but the fellows that did smoke were really having a hard time because there were no cigarettes there. And they rolled up grass and paper and tried and smoke that. And it was, so when they got the cigarettes, that was probably much more. And the old Henry bars made us all sick because we hadn't eaten solid food for a long time. And it was 40 pounds in 45 days. And there were some men that were bigger than I was that lost more pounds than that, too. So,
tell me, your release then was when?
Well, we got really, he arranged this exchange. Mm-hmm. It was supposed to be rank for rank, a able-bodied German for all of us, even those of us who were wounded and so forth. Mm-hmm. They wanted able-bodied Germans, and for rank, and so they had a day when they just called a truce, 9 o'clock in the morning till 5 o'clock at night, and they arranged for this little exchange in the little town of Etel. Mm-hmm. They loaded us up that morning. We found out about a day before we left the camp to go do this, and they told us that in the morning, now we're going to take you to be exchanged. And we had a lovely breakfast that morning. they fed us well that day. It was the only time we ever had really anything to eat. And we went to this place, and the German officers and all met the American officers. They went in a little cafe, had some wine and coffee, and worked out the deal. And everything was going well until some of the Germans, who they brought to be exchanged, refused to be exchanged. Well, when you think about it, they were going into a place where they were going to have a scarcity of food, because the Germans had a lot more food than we did, but it was still pretty scarce. And they probably weren't going to do much fighting other than picking our patrols and so forth. And so they refused to go. So later in the day, the Americans had to give up a few more Germans for, I don't know this for a fact, but I was told that they gave 7 Germans for me. Because I was late in the day and they made an exchange.
You begin to worry. It was one at a time when people were being exchanged?
Yeah, there was a certain procedure, you know. Mm-hmm. You had to be sure you got the right rank and serial number.
That sounds very worrying.
And all that type of thing. Mm-hmm. And then the German doctors always give a physical to the German that they want to accept, because they want to be sure he's able-bodied. Oh. And so
it's a very time-consuming process. Yeah,
right. Mm-hmm. And they took care of the seriously wounded first, our wounded. Mm-hmm. And some of those were still on stretchers and so mm-hmm. forth, which took a longer time just to get them there, and because mm-hmm. They had to have come by ambulance and things of that sort. So
the truce ended, the prisoners were exchanged, and then what happened to you next?
Well, I went back, and of course, the first thing we did, we got deloused, because mm-hmm. there were things crawling all over. We only had one set of clothes, you know, mm-hmm. for 45 days. And then we started eating, which was more of a trauma than you can imagine, because almost everything made you sick, because you hadn't eaten anything. I remember the kitchen asked each one of us what we wanted to eat. Some of us thought we'd have pancakes and syrup. That really made us sick. So it took us a few days to do that. And and then we had a physical. And if we were in good shape, which I turned out to be, we were reassigned back to a unit, and you could go back to the units you were in before. So that's what I did.
So how long then did you take to recuperate before you were sent back to your unit?
That was about 5 days.
Mm-hmm. So that's a very short period.
Got back in time to go on a patrol and capture one of the old guards.
Now, you had said that you really hadn't gone through boot camp, essentially. So what kind of combat training did you have, or did you not have any?
We really didn't have any other than the non-commissioned officers. Mm-hmm. I was not alone in this. There was lots of others that had mm-hmm. been in the same boat. So they'd hold little training sessions off by the side somewhere. I had never knew nothing about a rifle.
So you had no rifle training?
No. And so you had to learn how to disassemble it and clean it. And
what was your rifle? Was it a...
It was an M1.
M1. So you were learning to shoot while you were in combat, essentially.
Well, it was... No, see, this happened... My training was still in the United States after I left APA. Mm-hmm. No one ever shot at me while we were in training. But we were well trained by the time we got to New York to go to Europe.
So, okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, so.
Okay, it's 5 days after you've returned, and where are we located? We're still in France.
Still around Lorient.
Okay. And how long did your unit or your company then, or regiment, I should say, stay in that area?
We left there in the last part of December, which was after the Battle of the Bulge started. Mm-hmm. We rode for trucks for about 3 days and went directly into front lines in the Battle of the Bulge.
Mm-hmm. Would you like to talk about that?
Well, that was a little, certainly a different type of war than we'd been out on patrol and so forth. But the main thing was that it was extremely cold. And so you always had to fight the cold. We happened to be on what they call the southern end of the bulge. We had a lot of hard fighting in small German towns in the Saar, near the Saar River and in there and so forth. And, of course, that was a time when it was so cold that sometimes you couldn't get back to get warm because you'd stick your head out of a foxhole or something to get shot. And a lot of people froze. That's where they froze, frozen feet and so forth. And at the end of January, the last week in January, I went back for a little rest in one of the towns and found out that I was frozen from the waist down. Took off my boots and my feet swelled up in a hurry and split open. And so I went to the hospital for 30 days.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What kind of treatment do they give you for that?
I laid in the bed, flat on my back, with no covers that covered my legs. They were exposed to the air at all times. And every so often the doctor would come in and look around. They'd stick pins in your feet when they first started and didn't feel anything. Mm. And they had to restore the circulation. Mm-hmm. And if they didn't, they took off your leg. Mm-hmm. So...
Have you had any residual health problems as a result of that experience?
Well, I'm right now considered 100% disabled. Mm-hmm. But I only got that for three years ago because of some new legislation and so forth. And they went back and checked out all that stuff and so forth. I found out some of the fellows that were in prison with me have been declared disabled many 10, 15 years ago or so.
Now, you were in the hospital for 30 days and did your... obviously, your circulation was restored, but did everything heal and they considered you fit then to return?
Oh, yeah. I went back to my unit.
It was still very cold.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And when I went back, we did a lot of traveling by truck because by that time the bulge was pretty well taken care of and the Germans were really on the run. Mm-hmm. Some days we'd ride a truck all day and stop overnight somewhere and expect to have a battle the next day. Well, there weren't any Germans there, so you took off again. Mm-hmm.
Now, the earlier fighting before you were hospitalized, was that a kind of house-to-house kind of combat?
Oh, well, yes. In this one little town called Ninning, we took the town from the Germans, and they came back and took it back from us. And we took it from them again. They came back and took it. So we traded that off. That was pretty gory there. Mm-hmm. We usually were able to remove our dead, but the Germans weren't. They just lay in the streets mm-hmm. for 3 or 4 days there.
Do you feel that the officers who were in charge were fair in terms of the way they handled the soldiers, and things were equal in the way you went out?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Hmm. Well, they were very equal because you were getting replacements daily, mm-hmm. Either from wounds or from frostbite. Mm-hmm. And we left Nenning. When Nenning, we finally held on to it. The day that we took off from Nenning, our company, which would have been 50 or 60 men, to go across a little valley up and try and take a hill on the other side, which we did, but there was only 13 of us that made it to the hill. And then the next day, of course, they were all replaced with people, some never even been in combat before. Mm-hmm. And I remember you asked, mentioned an officer. There was a second lieutenant that was assigned to us. It was scared to death because he just got out of officer training school. Mm-hmm. And we had these dugouts in the, well, hillsides that we could jump in if we heard a shell coming or something. And he jumped into one of those, and it warmed up a little that day, and it fell in on him. None of the rest of us even jumped because, well, you become accustomed. When you hear the whine of the shell, you know where it's going to go, and you sort of disregard it. It's the ones that you don't hear are the dangerous ones. But
what was it like for you all then to be losing people and then having replacements coming in, and some of these people were... this was their first combat. Would you kind of take them under your wing, or what? How did all of that work?
Well, you had to. I don't recall it, whether you say you took them under your wing or not, but mm-hmm. you certainly warned them about things that you do. They were very disbelieving of the fact that when you'd hear a shell, that you shouldn't jump somewhere to get out of the way. Mm-hmm. But we wouldn't pay attention to that, but there was lots of replacements.
How would you evaluate the Germans that you were fighting against? What do you think? How do you think they stacked up in terms of their equipment or their strategy or their?
Well, the Germans in the Battle of the Bulge were crack troops. I mean, they were really the panzers, the tank men, and everything else were usually pretty extreme. But a lot of after you get by that level, that a lot of the replacements were either very young or very old, and they had a pretty hard life.
Now, besides the contact you had when you were in the prisoner of war camp for 45 days, did you continue to have contact with German soldiers as you proceeded through?
Well, you'd capture, mm-hmm. but you had very small contact with them. Mm-hmm. Mainly, you wanted to be sure they didn't have any guns or anything on them, mm-hmm. and then you sent them back to the back of the line somewhere, and someone else took care of them. Mm-hmm. So you didn't do that. But
so after the Battle of the Bulge, and you're proceeding, where are you heading when you're on these trucks and following the movement of the Germans who are retreating?
We went to our company went to Lubitschafen, which is on the Rhine River, and we thought we was going to have to fight to get across that river. Time we got there, the Germans were pretty well running, and then we had troops in the Saar Valley, where the industrial part of Germany was at that time, that were fighting. We were south of that, sort of just bottling up the Germans, that I didn't have any serious battles until after we'd crossed the Rhine River in the Saar Valley there, which would have been middle of March or late March or something. Mm-hmm. And Germans weren't too avid fighters at that time. Mm-hmm. The Russians were coming to Berlin, getting to close to Berlin, and so.
Were you aware of that? That the Germans were also coming? You know, as a soldier, did you have news of that?
You got that through capturing Germans, and mm-hmm. they tell you, you know, that they're done fighting. They didn't want to fight mm-hmm. anymore, and so forth. But they didn't tell me that, but that's the information we got from. Mm-hmm.
Is there anything you would like to say about that particular battle that you had just mentioned in the Saar Valley? What was that battle called?
It was just the Rhineland was one of the. Mm-hmm. It was. A lot of it was fighting in woods, and. As long as you had a tank around, it helped. But
that sounds very tricky, fighting in the woods.
Yeah. But first of all, they can be hiding in there, mm-hmm. and the other is, of course, the trees are cut down, line of sight, and everything like that. But
How do the tanks proceed through the woods? Do they? Do you have to have people like engineers chopping down trees?
No, they just run. If they couldn't run over them, they wouldn't mm-hmm. do that. I mean, mm-hmm. Then of course you had the Air Force that was bombing too. Sometimes they got a little close to to you, mm-hmm. but that never happened very often.
Now, after the Rhineland expedition, what happened to you in terms of your next experience?
Well, the war ended in May, so it was that was near the end of the war, mm-hmm. and I was in. Well, I guess when the war ended, I was in the Rhineland area, and we became military police, really, getting the civilians and everything lined up. But eventually I ended up in Czechoslovakia meeting the Russians as they were coming from the east.
Mm-hmm. And what was your job in Czechoslovakia with the Russians?
Mainly keep them on the other side of the railroad track. Mm-hmm. Which was interesting because they didn't mind us going on over their side, but we sure didn't want them over on our mm-hmm. side.
It was so just, we were trying to occupy territory and making sure that the Russians would not further come further.
Right.
Okay.
So, I was in Czechoslovakia when I got enough points to be discharged.
Mm-hmm. While you were in Czechoslovakia, did you have any contact with the civilian population?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What were some of the stories that those people related to you about their war experiences?
Well, the part that we were in, they were very bitter against the Germans mm-hmm. because they had come in and stolen their cattle, and or not necessarily stolen it, but at least mm-hmm. maybe butchered it and ate it or something. But they were pretty bitter about it. Mm-hmm. And we really didn't have a lot of. We ended up being stationed in this just a small village. Our company was sort of in charge of that village, mm-hmm. and it was spring, and they were starting the planning, and they were trying to get their lives back to normal again.
So you were the government for the village?
No, not really. They had their own government. Mm-hmm. One of the things, there was a this was always happening after the end of the war. There were people that cooperated with the Germans, which now then the rest of the population didn't appreciate. And that got rather nasty at times with some of the civilians fighting other civilians and so on.
Are there any things that you would like to talk about in terms of people that are very memorable to you during this experience or other events that you would like to mention?
Well, actually, as a whole, we came, we didn't have a lot of contact with the civilian population, except around Lorient there. But we soon learned you couldn't trust them because they could go back and forth between the Germans and so forth. And the day we were captured, they brought us... I said we had five killed, and the one of those pictures that you're going to see later is at the cemetery where we buried them, but we only buried four, and one of them was missing. And what had happened was that his body got stolen by a Frenchman, and the Frenchman put him in a wheelbarrow and flew him back to our lines. But when he got there, he didn't have any clothes or anything. The Frenchman had taken all that. But so,
are there any people in the army who were friends of yours that you would like to mention or talk about, or any officers?
Well, we had of course, my best friends were those that were captured with me, and some of them, after they were released, that was the end of the war for them because of various things. But there were 12 of us that got together for this documentary that I hadn't, well, some of them I hadn't heard of since we were exchanged. And some of them I'd been in contact with. I think I was the only one that went clear through the war without... being disconnected from our outfit.
Beside your frostbite, did you suffer any other wounds during the...
Well, I got blown up by a mine. It was on one of these patrols in Lorient. This was a hedgerow company, country, and there was a little gap in the hedgerow, and you always were suspicious that this was at night, and... we always looked for tripwires and things and those. And sure enough, here was this opening with a tripwire. And only problem was that a darn cat was around there. And somebody scared the cat and he ran through the tripwire and blew it up. It turned out to be just a little one of those little pop grenades that I was in the hospital for 3 days. Well, didn't even go to a regular hospital, just an aid station for 3 days. I had a piece of shrapnel on my cheek and blown up. Blew the gun out of my hands and so forth. But, another fellow was with me there. It was the same thing. So,
is there anything else you would like to talk about in terms of your war experiences in Europe that we haven't touched on?
Yeah. Well, I received some medals and so forth. I don't know. I got a Silver Star and the Bronze Star and a Purple Heart for my cat adventure.
And I believe that they're with us today, and we'll take a look at those when we finish the interview. So you received enough points to go back home, and that was in December of 1945. How did you get back home?
Well, I took... many truck rides from Czechoslovakia to Le Havre, got on a boat and went to New York and came home for 30 days. When I was home, I found out I'd won the Silver Star, which gave me enough points that I could be discharged. So when I went back to Fort Sheridan at the end of my leave, I was discharged.
Were you in contact with your family then after you, after you were out of the prisoner of war?
Oh, yeah.
They came to realize that you weren't missing.
They found out, three or four days after, because they were notified. But I think the first communication that they got was from me was in the middle of December.
When, after you were discharged, what happened to you after that?
I came here at the university.
So you went back to
school. In January, the semester started, and I entered school.
And what was it like to be back in school after being through this experience of war?
Well, I guess, first of all, I'm very unique because I was one of the first veterans to come back. And the V-12 boys were here. In fact, I had one for a roommate.
Could you tell me what the V-12
was? V-12 was a Navy officer training thing, which the university had at that time. I roomed with him for a while. Then they set up some sort of a preference for housing to live in the dorms. I lived in the dorm, but and there were only three dorms for men that time. That's the three across from Huff Gym. So I got in there and had a second semester junior standing, which was the old man of the group.
How old were you?
Well, let's see, I was 22 then.
Then when did you, what were you studying when you came back? Did you continue with your history or did
math.
You change?
Well, I concentrated in math.
Math.
So.
And what year did you graduate from the University of Illinois?
In 1946.
And did you continue your education?
Well, I didn't. I eventually got a master's degree from Bradley. And then I got a doctorate from the Illinois and... 72, I guess.
And when did you get married?
Got married in 1959. I have two children.
Did this experience of being in World War II, did that affect your life? And if so, how, in what way?
Oh, I suppose it did. I never even thought about it. The only thing I used to tell people was that when they'd get all excited about things that weren't going too right, I'd say, well, forget it. It'll get better. I don't know that. I don't know what my life is going to be before. I didn't have enough of it before I went in.
Mr. Harden, would you like to say anything else before we end the interview?
I don't think so.
Okay. Well, thank you very, very much. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Fine.
Henry, we have a number of things that we would like to keep.
Yeah, we just need it.
We'd have been here all night trying to get you to be still, the camera to be still.
He's still there.
Yes, if you go right out this door, you'll see it to your left.
Flag or
I think we're going to pass on the flag.
some other men who couldn't live at that time. Mm-hmm. One man had back surgery.
Five veterans that had interesting stories that I heard about, you know, from them, and that have died in the last probably 6 years or so. And Ken Bernstein, he said one of the things that got him going was the fact that
they're not even all on.
I was going to say, is there a time when they're all on?
Sometimes. During fun drives, they're off and on.
Do you keep any of these videos?
Burns.
It's just sometimes it's helpful for genealogical purposes.
Oh.
So I usually try and, yeah, I have forgotten to ask you.
It said 60 on the bottom of that letter.